Let me just simply say a little bit about myself, not because I want to talk about myself, but because it's probably important for you to know where I am coming from in the things I say to you today. I want to tell you that I was a dairy farmer in Gippsland in Victoria. I grew up on a dairy farm and worked on the dairy farm for the early years of my life. There were eight of us in the family. We milked cows, and our motto was, "We must all pull together." I was converted at the age of 17 on the same night as my father and my elder brother. At 18, because it was a little Methodist church in which I was converted, at 18 I went to a Methodist college to train for the ministry. At 19, I was pastor of my first church. Their favourite hymn in those days was "Green Pastures Are Before Us." They didn't come any greener than I was at that time. At 22, I married Julie, to whom I am still married. We spent 11 years with the leprosy mission, and then 2.5 years in full-time pastoral ministry at Eastleigh Gospel Chapel in Melbourne, and the last 15 years at Elkana, currently a pastoral elder in a church that's made up of 7 different denominations, and that makes me an expert on conflict. I guess I've been a Christian now for something like 30 years, and I understand my Christian life in much the same way, I think, as John Bunyan must have understood it, as a journey. Not simply a year-by-year celebration of a born-again experience, which was the magical end of all human problems, but a journey that began at the cross, that ends at the celestial city, and has had plenty of sloughs of despond and monsters in the jungle and all the things that John Bunyan's pilgrim found. And I think that on my journey I have discovered that there are two things that I have to focus my eyes on. The first is I have to focus my eyes on my Lord, for He walked the journey before me. But the second thing I have to be aware of is my own humanness and the frequency with which I respond to crises in my life. First of all, out of my humanness, despite the fact that hopefully I've got my eyes on the Lord. But what I find hard to do, and what I find other Christians seem to find it hard to do, is to own the struggle that comes out of their humanness. And I guess if anything will characterize my particular presentations on this weekend, it will be the encouragement to you as Christian men to not live behind a veneer of spiritual language and expectations of how Christians ought to feel and how they ought to act, but I will be encouraging you to come to grips with who you are, to own it, and to know that in a great rich sense, to know the truth is to be set free. To recognize and acknowledge who I am and what I need God to do in my life is a very, very important issue. As long as I deny my struggles and deny my pain, I will live in conflict in my Christian experience. Some years ago, our television broke down. 12 years ago. It's still waiting to be fixed. We decided that we would try living without television. I might tell you, it works really well. As surprising as it might sound, you can actually survive without television. But when we go on holidays, we enjoy watching it, particularly if there's cricket or football on it. But on one occasion, while we're on holidays, I got to see an Agatha Christie movie. And I found there was a lady on the Agatha Christie movie called Miss Marple. Have you heard of her? Good, I'm glad you've heard of her. Miss Marple was always somehow on the scene before the police. And she always solved the problem before the police, which actually made her a pill as far as the police were concerned. And on this particular story of Agatha Christie's, Miss Marple was getting in the hair of a young police inspector who complained about her to an old police inspector. And he said, "Young man, don't ever underestimate Miss Marple. She knows her village so well that through it she knows the whole world." And you know, that's almost become a philosophy of my life. I believe that if we dare to know ourselves really well, and if we dare to know the people around us really well, through that experience we will know the whole world. For although everybody is unique, and everybody is a unique model, there is a sense in which our responses to life's crises are fairly uniform. There are a restricted number of ways in which humans respond to the world around them. And if we understand the way we respond, if we understand our Achilles' heels, our weaknesses, our struggles, our pain, then we will understand the struggles and pain of the world around us. But if we don't, we won't. And I want to say that right at the beginning. And the second thing I want to say is, I want to give an explanation for why I was keen to talk about conflict. I'm keen to talk about it because I think right now, in the church in Australia, is probably the biggest issue. But it's probably true that it always has been. We've just had different names for it. A few years ago, I was privileged to hear, speaking in Melbourne, a man by the name of Juan Carlos Ortiz, a great South American preacher, probably the pastor of the biggest church in the world. Just happens that he was charismatic, but I hope you won't hold that against him. A tremendous preacher. And he was preaching to a largely Pentecostal audience, and he was laying it on them that the reason Pentecostal churches are growing across the world was not so much out of evangelical fervour, but out of splits and divisions. And he told the story of the chocolate and candy church. He said in a certain town, there was a group of 3-year-olds got together, and they said, "The greatest thing in the world is chocolate and candy." And so on the basis of all believing that the greatest thing in the world was chocolate and candy, they met together in great unity. And they got on really well for a number of years. And then one day, right in the middle of a worship service, a 5-year-old stood up and said, "Brothers and sisters, I have discovered that there is something in life more exciting than chocolate and candies." And the rest of them said, "Heresy, throw him out." He said, "Wait, let me tell you. It's tricycles." They said, "That's heresy, throw him out." So they threw him out. And he went down the street and he started a tricycle church. And all the 5-year-olds and the 6-year-olds joined it. And it went really well. There were 2 big churches in the street. And then one day a 7-year-old stood up. Said, "Brothers and sisters, I've discovered there's something more important in life, more exciting than tricycles." They said, "Heresy, throw him out." He said, "Now listen to me, bicycles, oh that's terrible, throw him out." So they threw him out. He went down the next street and he started another church. It was called a bicycle church. Went really well for a number of years. Then somebody stood up and said, "Brothers and sisters, I've discovered something much more exciting in the life than bicycles." They said, "Oh, not again. Throw him out. Heresy." He said, "No, wait, listen to me. Go-karts. That's awful. Throw him out." So he went down the church and started a go-kart church. He said, "That's been the history of the Pentecostal church in Australia." Because of conflict, we have grown more churches. Because of division, not commission. And I am afraid that it's not only true of the Pentecostal church. I think it has been true of assemblies as well. And I have seen churches divided and split over issues that you would not believe. I saw a United Church split because somebody wanted to move the pulpit from the center of the church to the side. I saw a church split, several churches in Victoria recently split, because they wanted to sing choruses in church as well as hymns. I saw another church split because some of the leading brethren would not tolerate anything else other than the authorized version. It was good enough for Paul, it's good enough for us. Now it's true, and we can laugh about it. I hope we can laugh about it, but it is true. It's happening still in our world. We still have chocolate and candy churches. Why is it happening? It's not happening because of the issues, is it? The issues are not splitting churches. What's splitting churches is that in churches there are people in conflict. And that's why my definition on the first page of my notes is very important. It's not my definition, it's a definition by a guy called J. Newton Maloney, a lecturer at Fuller Seminary who was with us at Elkano a few years ago. And he says this: conflict is a moment in time when personal survival becomes more important than either maintaining the goodwill of other people and more urgent than resolving the present crisis. Let me read that to you again, and you follow it through and struggle with it. I'm not asking you to agree with it straight away. I'm asking you to struggle with it. That's the best way of learning. Don't ever just agree with me, okay? Or you could get led down the garden path. Struggle with it. Conflict is a moment in time when personal survival becomes more important than either maintaining the goodwill of other people and more urgent than resolving the present crisis. Now let's get into a few other definitions so that we understand where I'm coming from. There is a difference between problems and conflict. A conflict is a moment in time when personal survival becomes more important than other things. A problem is simply differences of opinion about whether and how to do something or think about it. So I could have a problem with my brother about where we go for our Sunday school picnic or how we put the seats in the church, but that doesn't have to become a conflict. I can even have a problem about some sort of biblical interpretation, and believe it or not, that doesn't have to become a conflict. A problem is a problem, and a problem can be solved by discussion. But a conflict is different, and conflicts can rarely be solved by discussion. Because I am in conflict the moment I feel that my personal identity is somehow under threat. Conflicts can be reduced by restoring self-esteem, because I am in conflict when my self-esteem is under threat. Conflicts are inside us. They are not necessarily something that's going on between us and someone else. A conflict is a state of mind. It's very important to understand that. Now think about yourself for a moment, and you'll probably remember times when you have gone into conflict. Something that has been very important to you has suddenly been attacked, put under attack, and you have felt your tummy tie itself in a knot. You felt a lump in your throat. You felt yourself ready to, you felt that the blood rushed to your cheeks, and suddenly, inexplicably, you are angrier than you intended to get, because you are in conflict. I remember one time being in a meeting where the discussion was whether we should use grape juice for communion or real stuff. One guy got up and he was for the real stuff. And he said, I was born a brethren. I will die a brethren. But if you introduce grape juice to communion, I'll leave immediately. That's good logic. But he was in conflict. Why? Because somehow his Christian faith was built on tradition. And we were about to remove part of his tradition. And his identity was under threat. And logic wasn't important anymore. He was angry and his fists were clenched and his face was red. He was in conflict. There are many examples in Scripture of people who were in conflict. Jonah was in conflict because God was asking him to do something that was an anathema to all that he believed and stood for, and he was in conflict and he ran away from God, and when Nineveh was converted, he was depressed and angry and upset. He was in conflict. The rich young ruler was in conflict. He wanted to follow Jesus, and Jesus said, if you're going to follow me, you need to sell everything you've got and give it away and follow me. And he walked away sadly. He couldn't deal with that. Jesus was attacking the whole center of his identity and all of his security. And when that happens, we are in conflict. I will talk during this series about dying psychologically. And what that means, and what I will mean by that, is to lose my sense of identity and my status. By identity, I mean who I am to you. Have you ever sat down beside somebody you've never met before and said to him, what do you do? And he says, I am a plumber. I am an accountant. I am a carpenter. You didn't ask him who he was. You asked him what he did. Huh? But he told you what he was. Because for many of us, our identity is who we are to other people. If you see me as a person of worth and of value, if my parents saw me as a person of worth and value, if I was seen by my school colleagues as a person of worth and value because I was good at sport or good at education or good looking, then I felt good about who I was. But if I had big ears or fat legs or big nose or buck teeth or knobby knees and that's what they saw me as, then basically I felt bad about who I was. Self-esteem is identity is who I am to you, and status is the value of that identity. I remember deciding to try this out one day. And on a plane, somebody said to me, what do you do for a living? I said, I'm a farmhand. Which is true, I used to be one. They said, oh. And that was the end of the conversation. But whenever I have said, I'm a marriage counsellor, everybody wants to talk to me. Because they put more value on marriage counsellors than they do farmhands. That status. And identity and status is very important to us, even to those of us who deny it. It's better for us to own it's true than it is to deny it, because it just happens to be true. That identity and status is important to us, basically. And when our identity and status is under threat, That means I am dying psychologically, and when I am in danger of dying psychologically, I go into conflict. And that's what happens when an issue arises in your church and someone gets irrationally upset. They're under threat. I remember one day, after I'd been in the assemblies for a very short time, and I had been asked to be an elder in this particular church, and in this particular church they decided to change their morning program. They decided, instead of having worship at 9:30 and Sunday school at 11, they would have an all-age education program at 9:30 and worship at 11. I thought that sounded a tremendous idea. The other elders asked me to make the announcement. I was fairly naive in those days. And I wasn't quite sure why they had chosen me. I found out. I made the announcement with all the enthusiasm and excitement that I had about that project. And as I was walking down the aisle after the service, a little old lady stepped out into the aisle and she said, "Young man, that's of the devil." She said, I was shocked. And she said, "Worship must always come before service." I never heard that before. And I said, "Is that in the Bible?" She said, "Yes." I said, "Can you tell me where?" She said, "Not just now, but I will next Sunday." But she never did. She's still looking. But she was in conflict. Didn't matter that it wasn't logical, wasn't rational, wasn't even scriptural. She was in conflict. Something had happened that Sunday morning that threatened her. She was about to die psychologically, and she was going to get stuck into me as a response. And that's happening all around our churches, isn't it? You've seen it happen. It happens in our marriages. It happens out in the secular world. People in conflict, and sometimes they don't even understand why. I just wanted to draw your attention in this first session to two passages of Scripture where Jesus talks about people in conflict. The first one is in Matthew chapter 5. I see Dr. Gibbs is also going to speak about this passage. Oh no, I think it's Tom is going to speak about this passage. Chapter 5, verse 21 to 26. It says, "You've heard that it was said to the men of old, 'You shall not kill, and whoever kills shall be liable to judgment.' But I say to you," Jesus says, "I say to you, that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother shall be liable to the council. Whoever says 'you fool' shall be liable to the hell of fire. So if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go first to be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. Make friends quickly with your accuser while you are going with him to court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge, and the judge to the guard, and you be put in prison. Truly I say to you, you will never get out till you've paid the last penny." The emphasis is on reconciliation, but let me just for now put the emphasis on another point, and that's the point of hatred, of anger leading to hatred, and hatred leading to division and destruction. And anger comes out of being in conflict. The other passage is in Matthew chapter 6. And there's a beautiful passage about trusting God. Verse 31. "Therefore do not be anxious, saying, 'What shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear?' For the Gentiles seek all those things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them all. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things shall be yours as well. Therefore do not be anxious about tomorrow, for tomorrow will be anxious for itself. Let the day's own trouble be sufficient for the day. If my goal is security, if my goal is material things, if my goal is to meet my immediacy needs, then the moment that is under threat, I will be in conflict. And some of us know the conflict that comes out of the pressure of life, the pressure of our economic issues, the pressures of family. I wanted to... Can I come across that blackboard without you losing me, or should I have another microphone for that? I want you to imagine that you're in a yacht. I want you to imagine that's a yacht. You're sailing across a beautiful, calm bay. The wind is just right. The sun is shining. You're laying back in the boat, enjoying it. It's just what the doctor ordered. Just the perfect thing to do on a Saturday morning. That's success. Then suddenly the wind freshens and changes direction. And you leap up and you grab the ropes and you set the sails and you struggle. You lean out over the boat like they used to do in the America's Cup. And you're really in there, sailing the boat for all your worth, using all your skills. And that's fantastic. The adrenaline's running and your heart is beating and you wouldn't change places with anybody anywhere else in the world. That's stress. But it's good stress. Without a little bit of stress, without the right amount of stress, you'd be dead, right? You have to have some stress, and that's the enjoyment. And then suddenly you look down and there's a big hole in the bottom of the boat and the water is pouring in and you let the ropes go and you leap down and you grab a bucket and you start bailing for all your worth, but the water is getting deeper and deeper in the boat. That's distress. Are you in conflict here?
No.
Are you in conflict here?
No.
You're in conflict here?
Yes.
That's life sailing along. That's a problem. That's a conflict. Because you're under attack. You're about your survival right now. Your personal survival is more important than anything else. You don't care whether you sail that boat in a straight line. You don't care. You don't care where the wind's coming from. All you care is that you can bail out the water faster than it come in. Your personal survival is now more important than anything else. And that's the way I want you to understand conflict as we talk about it. Just while I get my notes. Somewhere on this continuum, a problem ceases to become a problem and someone goes into conflict. And conflict involves a desperate attempt to regain self-esteem. So when a person is under threat and they become angry, they are really striving to win back some self-esteem. They're really striving to find their identity again and to lift who they are in your eyes and in the eyes of people who are inclined now to disregard them or put them down. And the angrier they get, the more they are striving to save the situation as they see it. But in actual fact, they're driving wedges between them and others. And because they get angry, they put other people in conflict and they get angry back, and before long, you've got a crisis you can't resolve. And that's why two people in conflict never resolve anything. If I am in conflict and you are in conflict and we have a problem, then we're never going to resolve it, because I'm not going to listen to you because I'm under threat. And you're not going to listen to me because you're under threat. And because we don't listen to each other and don't understand each other, we'll never resolve the problem. And there are many, many situations in our churches like that. I want also to make the comment in this first session that ego involvement means the degree to which you are involved, invested and convicted about an issue. There is a correlation between the degree of ego involvement and the degree of vulnerability to conflict, and that poses a problem for the Christian. Because we want Christians to be ego involved, in the good sense, in their Christian life. We want them to be strongly convicted, deeply convinced, and completely invested in what they believe about Jesus Christ. But it makes us very vulnerable to conflict. Because the moment we think that some aspect of what we believe is under attack, we go into conflict because something very important to us is under attack. What we have to do as Christians is recognize the difference between the real issues in the Christian life and the superficial issues that are negotiable. In our little church at Marysville is a town of 600 people. We have a church with a membership of 80 and a morning congregation of 120. It's not really a brethren assembly. It was started as a little indigenous Christian fellowship. And in the first meeting of people who got together, there were 7 different denominations represented. You just imagine. Can you imagine the problems that could have come up where out of about 20 people, there were 7 different denominations represented? Just try to think with me what happened when we got to talk about communion. We had Salvation Army people there who didn't have it at all. We had Presbyterians who had it once a quarter with grape juice in little cups and bread in little squares. We had Baptists who had it once a month in bread in one big loaf and grape juice in little cups. We had brethren who had the real stuff in big cups with one big loaf of bread. We had Anglicans who had it every morning, real stuff, and little wafers. We had all that in one church. But I want to tell you that the wonderful thing is that in 7 years we have never had a conflict over communion. We did some beautiful piece of compromising. We have it every morning with grape juice in little cups and one big loaf. We decided that the most important thing was that we focus on Christ, on His death, on His resurrection, on His coming again. And we decided that the way the Marysvillian Christians were going to do that was with little cups, grape juice, and one big loaf. And we didn't really care how others did it. And you know, we've never had a conflict over it. Isn't that interesting? And as long as we can sort out the real issues from the superficial, traditional issues, we don't have to have conflict in the church. But as long as my self-esteem is somehow tied to tradition, I'm going to be vulnerable to conflict. Always that will be so. 4 things which are usually occasions for conflict. Let me share those with you quickly. The first one is other people. Other people will put us into conflict because of their styles, their different styles of doing things, because of their personalities, because of their attitudes, and because of their behaviours. You'll just walk into a place and you'll be a quiet, introverted sort of a guy and you'll see a loud, extroverted bloke holding the floor and you'll think, what a pill. He's just different. But his loudness And his extrovertness can sometimes make you feel insignificant, or angry, or upset, or irritable. You get on a leadership group with someone who wants to do things a different way, and suddenly, because you've always done it a certain way, you're in conflict. And then issues are a source of conflict. Plans, projects, programs, ways, means, ends, priorities, preferences cause conflict. So a wonderful way to cause conflict in the church is to get everybody to stand up in church and tell you what the priority of the church ought to be. They've got all different priorities. None of them are wrong. All the priorities are right. And they come out of the particular Christian experience of the person who is talking about them. A young person is going to stand up and say, or a parent of young people is going to stand up and say, the priorities of this church is youth. The elderly are going to say, what about caring for the old people of this district? The young marrieds are going to say, why don't the older women teach the younger women to love their husbands? That's a priority. You know why that never happens? No one wants to admit they're older. So it sort of depends where you're at, what your priorities are. None of them are wrong. But you can get conflict the moment you start talking about priorities. And then the third thing is the physical world. Our physical world. Our own physical strength. Time, space, faulty machinery, slow mail. Anything that goes wrong around us can throw us into conflict. I handed the other day a document to my secretary to type. She said, I'm sorry, it can't be done today. I said, what do you mean it can't be done today? It has to be done today. She said, well, there's a power failure. The power won't be on till 3 o'clock this afternoon. So we've got electric typewriters, no document. And suddenly I was in conflict. The newspaper article had to be in the next day. There was no way I was going to make it, and I was upset. The problem was I should have done it the day before. But I was upset by something that went wrong in my physical world. Do you ever get upset like that? Sometimes I look across at the driver beside me at the red light, and I see him thumping his wheel with his fist, revving his motor. He's in conflict because the light turned red. I used to have a car that was very good at taking off from lights. And I used to delight in just taking off from the lights faster than anybody else at the lights and then slowing down while they all roared past me. It was interesting how many people you could put in conflict just simply doing that. The physical world is a ripper. I could tell you a beautiful story about that, but I haven't got time. And then our own personal limits can put us in conflict. Our strength, our memory. You ever gone to introduce somebody to somebody else and suddenly can't remember their name? And you feel all sort of upset because you've blown it again. And our weaknesses can become a source of conflict. I wanted to make a quick comment that our identity and our status refer to relationship roles. Whenever there's a conflict between a teacher and a pupil, there's an identity status issue here. And the same is true of a husband and wife, a doctor, a patient, a father, a child, a pastor and his flock, and an employer and his employee. That frequently there is a status identity issue. The pastor is in conflict about his status, and the flock is often in conflict about its identity. The teacher is in conflict about his status because he can't get the kids to do what he wants. The kids are in conflict about their identity because the teacher has just called them a big dumb lot. And often in conflict, identity and status is an issue. I wanted to just draw your attention to seven common ways that people react to conflict. Then I'm going to stop for any questions that you might have, and then we're going to have some short discussion. Seven major ways in which people react to conflict. The first one is escape. Get out of the situation. And this person who escapes out of conflict by backing away and leaving, pretending that the conflict is non-existent, has no concern for the people involved and no concern for the issues involved. All he wants is to dodge the pain. You've met people like that, I'm sure, and some of us might be like that. We have a fear of pain, and rather than confront and face conflict, we will escape from it. We'll leave the church and go to another church. We'll get out of that discussion and get into another discussion. We have four children, and they're all basically grown up now, and they've developed some reasonably, what would you say, some radical ideas about their Christian faith and where it relates to political issues. And they have some relatives who are more right-wing than the Argus Khan. And whenever those relatives visit us, our kids just delight in dropping little comments like, the royal family's a waste of money. I mean, that's an innocent enough comment. But immediately, the lady relative of this situation jumps in and begins to accuse our sons of everything from being communist to being non-Christian. And then the husband, her reaction is to get in there, boots and all, and she loves it. Her husband's reaction is to say, stop it, I don't want any of this discussion, let's change the subject. And then if that doesn't work, he goes out and looks at the garden. He escapes. The second common way of responding to a conflict is to surrender. That's to give up while staying in the situation, but not resolving anything. And in this situation, we're showing no concern for the issue. It might be an important issue, but rather than stay in conflict over it, we just drop it. We usually end up getting walked on and becoming the doormat, but that seems to be better in our eyes than being resolving the conflict. The third way is retribution. That's get revenge. Counterattack. Make the other person pay. The fourth is retaliation. Do something to even the score. You touch my car, I smash your face. I saw a sticker on the back of a car the other day. And the fifth way to deal with conflict is aggression. The best defense is an offense. Get in there and fight them back. And don't give in. The sixth way is intimidation. Most frequently found in marriage. When you get into conflict, you know how to beat your wife in conflict? Raise your voice and use words she doesn't understand. That's intimidation. I'm losing, so I've got to do something about it. You can say you always know when a preacher is unsure of his subject because he uses words like obviously and absolutely and tries to intimidate his audience into believing he's really confident. And the seventh thing is vindication. The best defense is defense. Asserting myself and justifying myself. We discovered in Marriage Enrichment Ministries that the reason why husbands and wives frequently do not communicate well together is that whenever a comment seems to be a little attacking, the partner feels that the first response must be defense. Okay? So if a husband says to his wife, you are always late, she feels she has to defend. And she says, not always late. You're always sitting in the car tooting the horn. And you should be in here turning off the taps and closing the windows like I am. And so instead of listening to him, she goes into defense and self-justification. And so communication ends or deteriorates at that point. Because she is in conflict and she is reacting to it by self-vindication. The ideal way, which we'll be talking about this weekend, is a fourfold way of dealing with conflict. Assertiveness, confrontation, collaboration, and resolution. Now that's going to take us on to our next session, and we'll be talking a little bit more about what those things really mean. And we want to look at whether or not they are scriptural things to do. Some people think that it's not biblical to be assertive. We'll have a look and see whether it is or it isn't as we go along. The second thing I wanted to do was to respond to a feeling I got last night. And the feeling was that some of us may be struggling a little bit to understand where our Christian life and negative emotions actually come together. I got the feeling that some of us have decided that Christians don't have negative emotions, and that you weren't quite understanding where I was at last night. And I want to confess to you that I had a big struggle in this area for a long time. I remember reading Colossians chapter 3 in my early Christian life, and reading things about dwelling in heavenly places, seated with Christ, and reading about having put off the old man and put on the new man, and feeling, well, yes, that's fair enough. And then coming to verse 8, which says, "But now put them all away, anger, wrath, malice, slander, and foul talk from your mouth. Do not lie to one another, seeing that you have put off the old nature with its practices, and have put on the new nature, which is being renewed in knowledge after the image of its creator." And I thought, now what is all this about? If I have put off the old man and put on the new man, why do I still have to put off anger and malice and bitterness and all those negative emotions that surely should have belonged to the old man and gone when I put him off? And I really struggled with what Paul was really saying. It seemed like a little bit of a contradiction in terms. And I must confess to you that I never really understood that passage of Scripture until one day I was cleaning out my garage. And when I began to clean it out, I started three piles. I started a pile I called the keep pile, another one I called the throw away pile, and another pile I called the it might come in handy pile. I can see that you've cleaned your garage. When I had finished the job, I had a very insignificant throwaway pile, a not very much more significant keep pile, and this huge it might come in handy pile. I put the little throwaway pile in the boot of my car, had thought originally I might have needed a trailer, but put it in the boot of my car and took it down to the tip. Tips fascinate me. I spent 20 minutes looking around. I found a few more things that would come in handy. I took her to home, I put them into my garage, and I ended up with a slightly tidier but slightly fuller garage than when I started. And it suddenly struck me what Colossians 3 is about. You see, when I became a Christian, there was garbage that went out of my life at that moment of time, has never made a re-entry, and I have never had a longing to go back to it. But there are other things that disappeared out of my life for just a little while and then started to come back. I had a bad temper. As a teenager, a foul temper that almost landed me in very hot water. I took up aggressive sports as a teenager because that was a way of dealing with my aggression. Took up boxing and took up rodeo riding, and a range of things that in some way expressed my aggression. But when I became a Christian, my bad temper seemed to disappear for a little while, and I was delighted. But a few weeks later, I found it coming back again, and I was crushed. And a lot of the anger and resentment and bitterness that had marked my life began to return. And it really miffed me. I didn't understand it. But after I cleaned my garage out, I really did begin to understand it. You see, I had spent years of my life learning that certain things come in handy. When I was 2.5 years of age, probably, I learnt to throw a tantrum. If I didn't get what I wanted, I could throw myself on my back in the middle of the grocery store, kick my legs in the air, yell at the top of my ample voice, and I might just get a chocolate bar. I might also just get a clip in the ear, but it was worth the risk. And it must have worked often enough to decide that it would come in handy. You probably did something similar. And I see adults throwing tantrums quite frequently. You don't see them on their back in the supermarket kicking their legs, because that's embarrassing and it hurts when you hit your head on the floor. As adults, we throw tantrums in much more adult ways. We slam doors. We drive our car at 60 kilometres an hour down the driveway in reverse. We resign of committee meetings. We leave churches. We throw tantrums in adult ways. And then God comes along and he says, "Put away your tantrumic behaviour." And we say, "Fair go, God. If I put away anger, how am I going to get my own way?" It comes in handy. And so I hold on to it. And sadly, resentment and bitterness and rage are things that Christians frequently hold on to very tightly, because they use them at various times for good reason. You say, what's the good reason for being resentful? The good reason for being resentful is, if I stay resentful at someone who has hurt me, then I will never get hurt the same way again. That's a good reason. No one of us wants to be hurt emotionally. It's a good reason, but it's a bad method. And God says we ought to put it away, and we ought to exercise the biblical principle of forgiveness instead. But forgiveness makes us vulnerable. So we'd rather stay resentful. And I am afraid that I need to tell you this morning that of those 100 people a week that we see in our counselling centres, and the thousands that are seen by Christian counsellors all over Australia, 80% of those are Christians, and probably 90% of them have problems directly related to unresolved emotional issues in their lives. They are people in conflict, and they are people to whom we need to minister. But it also calls us to recognise that there are issues in our own lives that may still be waiting for us to deal with. When I first got involved with Christian Brethren Assemblies back in about 1965, I was thrilled at the fellowship and the Bible teaching that I received. When I became 29 in 1969, I was made an elder of the assembly, or asked to be an elder of the assembly, and the thing that struck me when that happened was to become aware of the cynicism amongst the young men of the assemblies. I was astounded at how cynical young Christian men were. I heard cynical comments about eldership, about leadership, about the Bible, about ministry, about the morning meeting, about the assembly in general. And I began to realize that a great deal of that cynicism came out of anger in these men's lives, an anger that related to issues that had happened in the church, anger that related to situations that had risen as they'd been brought up in very strict environments, an anger that related to the fact that they felt they'd been misunderstood and misrepresented. And because those issues had been unresolved in their lives and that anger had been internalized in their human spirit, then that anger was expressing itself in terms of cynicism and sarcasm and criticism in the assemblies. That was a long time ago. That was nearly 20 years ago. And I want to say that my feeling is that nothing much has changed. I believe that I could go into almost every assembly in Australia and most churches in Australia and quickly become aware of a high level of cynicism, criticism and sarcasm among the people of God. And those three things are indicators of unresolved angers and conflicts in our lives. In the last 10 years or so, Julie and I would have conducted something like 10 marriage enrichment programs every year. So that would be around about 100. We would normally have about 16 couples at those marriage enrichment events. So that, if my arithmetic is right, is about 1,600 couples. With the exception of a handful of those couples, they would all say that they had average marriages. You don't go to marriage enrichment because you've got a bad marriage. That's not the place for bad marriages or difficult problems. You go to marriage enrichment because you have a good marriage that you want to be better. Tragically, we haven't got that message across to many Christians yet who still haven't been. But of those 1,600 approximately marriages, we would believe that 70 to 80% of those people would admit by the end of the weekend that most of the problems of communication, conflict resolution and sexuality that they have encountered in their marriage years have been the direct results of unresolved hurts and pain in their relationship and in their individual lives. That's why the subject of conflict is really important.